By the time Eric got home from work, Bruce was starting to peak. Since Manhattan is such a tightly enclosed space, the neighborhoods tend to get recycled. What was once drug-ridden drive-by types of neighborhoods you wouldn't drive an armored car through quickly would eventually find favor with edgy and perennially broke creative types who would slowly but surely turn it into the next super hip neighborhood, and then the galleries and boutiques would move in and the rents would skyrocket and the broke edgy types would have to go find another rat-infested death trap to take over. So it was in the early 1980s with Manhattan's Lower East Side. Soho had already been colonized and priced out of reach, so developers and speculators were casting about, trying to find the next likely rundown neighborhood to go champagne supernova. One company decided to take a chance on a building in the terrifying Alphabet Town, a hotbed of heroin and urban decay named for the avenues that stretched east of First Avenue, Avenues A, B, and C. In the middle of this wasteland, one block east of Avenue B and one block south of Houston, stood a sturdy four-story brick building which had recently been refurbished into lofts by a developer hoping to be the first one into a hot new neighborhood. They were the first ones in by a long shot. There was nothing even remotely appealing or habitable for many blocks in either direction. To lure the right type of people in, the rents were low, but not as low as they were in the neighboring buildings, many of which, abandoned squats, had absolutely no rent whatsoever. The idea was to lure young, white, creative types in until the balance of the neighborhood started to shift, and then the prices would soar as it became the next Soho, and the developers would realize an enormous windfall. It was a risk, to be sure, both for the company that gambled on it and to the first tenants that moved in, but for the right type of person, it was a great deal. And apparently, Bruce and Eric and I were the right type of people. It was an odd set of circumstances that brought us together into that loft. Eric and I were best friends, soulmates, I'd even go so far as to say, and we had moved to the big bad city a couple of months earlier and were just starting to get established. Roommates for 2 years at the Interlochen Arts Academy, we both felt, and to some degree still feel, a level of comfort and acceptance around each other that is rare. Eric was a classically handsome, somewhat beefy guy, but with the sweetest heart you could hope to find. Often accused of being a GQ kind of guy, except for his, quirky fashion sense, he did actually appear once as a model on those vaunted pages. The girls, and half the guys, used to go crazy for him at school, which really got annoying after a while, but he was such a good friend that I didn't really mind much. We had managed to secure steady jobs and were no longer quite the risk we were when we had first arrived off the turnip truck, so we were ready to upgrade to a real apartment, as opposed to the sweltering 12x12 coffin we talked our way into upon first arriving. Bruce, a classmate of ours from Interlochen, had also recently moved to the city, but he was in considerably different circumstances. I recognized him from school, but we had never spent any time together. Since Bruce and Eric were both a year younger than me, they had gotten to know each other as seniors while I was off being tortured at the University of Chicago. Bruce was independently wealthy, although from horrific circumstances. His family had successfully sued the local power company after he nearly died grabbing an unmarked and unprotected high-voltage power line, which permanently fused the fingers of his right hand together. He had moved to the West Village and rented a small loft off Christopher Street to take in the wonders of the city. Slight of frame and light of hair, Bruce was outgoing and had a somewhat goofy sense of humor, and although he had an inherent band geek vibe, he played French horn at Interlochen, but he was in the band, not the orchestra, which, in the peculiar class system at Interlochen, puts you near the bottom of the social ladder. I suppose being in the band puts you at the bottom of the social ladder no matter where you go to school. Bruce was trying to overcome that image with expensive haircuts, sharp duds, lots of Bon Sertan and those logoed German wife beaters that were popular among that crowd at that time, and a sophisticated, read depraved, lifestyle. He spent his days shopping and his nights partying, and he lived the gloriously hedonistic lifestyle of the gay urban world, which was just beginning to feel the chill of the long shadow cast by AIDS. By the time Eric and I were ready to find a new place, Bruce was ready to get some roommates, and for some reason, he agreed to move in with us and provide the secure financial anchor that every landlord craved. One possible reason he wanted to live with us came into sharper focus near the end of our year together when he tried to engineer a three-way seduction while we were all tripping, which led to an awkward night and a lot of bad feelings all around. But that was months later. I was working days at a graphics service center, an extremely specialized support service to the graphics industry that made high-contrast, high-quality photographic reproductions of graphic artwork at various sizes to meet certain printing and publishing specifications, an industry that has been entirely obliterated thanks to computers. So Eric, who was working afternoons and evenings, and Bruce went out apartment shopping with my blessing. A few days later, they found a place they were interested in and arranged for me to take a look at it. Bruce was going to go down there in the evening, and Eric and I were to meet him there when Eric got done working. He came home from his shift at a fast food pasta place, changed clothes, smoked a bowl, and the two of us head out into the night to meet Bruce. Although it was quite a ways away, the apartment was, as stated, around Avenue B in Houston, and we lived at 23rd and 7th Avenue, a few doors down from the notorious Chelsea Hotel. It was a nice night, and we decided to walk. Eric had warned me that it wasn't the best neighborhood, and walking down there would also give me a better sense of it than just popping up out of the subway hole somewhere. Bad neighborhood was kind of subjective, as pretty much every neighborhood in New York City looked pretty bad to me, coming out of the North Woods of Michigan. Although, fortunately, I had just spent a year in Chicago's notorious South Side, so I was a bit more accustomed to gritty urbanism than I would have been if I'd just fallen out of a tree into Manhattan. We had made our way down to the Village, near CBGB's, and were walking down to Houston. Sure enough, as advertised, the neighborhood looked shitty. Graffiti was sprayed across the boarded-up windows of abandoned buildings, and junkies were curled up and nodding out in the dark corners. I kept assuring myself that it was okay. That was just the way the city was. It wasn't scary and depraved. It was edgy and cool. Eric and I chatted aimlessly, both of us listening more to our trouble radar than to each other. A sudden shout surprised me, and I glanced across the street to see a large black man carrying a duffel bag and pointing at me. When I met his gaze, he dropped the bag and raced across the street, heading right for me. Eric and I stopped in our tracks, frozen, unsure what to do. The man jumped up between two parked cars onto the curb and ran straight for me, clearly pissed off about something. Yelling incomprehensibly, he tried to kick me. I jumped back a step and his leg came flying towards me, his foot glancing harmlessly off my sturdy dancer's thigh. Steadying himself, he glared at me, muttered something incomprehensible, and ran back across the street to pick up his bag and continue along his twisted trajectory. Since arriving in Manhattan, I had been waiting for the bad thing to happen. Everybody said it was a big, scary place where all sorts of pain and suffering went down, usually at the hands of others. And I had been sort of subconsciously waiting for my bad thing to happen, wondering how I'd survive it, or if I would. Not long before that, I had been mugged in an elevator and dutifully handed over my cash without a struggle, just like I had been told to do. As hoped, it worked, and my mugger slithered off the elevator with my $50, all the money I had in the world at that moment, and I slunk back to my apartment, depressed but unharmed. Later muggings would find me a little less acquiescent, more willing to negotiate, until the last attempt in which I shoved the guy into a parked car and quickly ran across a busy street before he could get up. Stupid, perhaps, but much more New York-y. Now I had actually been assaulted on the street by a crazy guy and survived. My adrenaline and reflexes got me, mostly, out of harm's way, and I was oddly pleased to be able to carve that notch into my belt. By the time we got down into Alphabet Town, Eric and I had stopped talking entirely, spending all of our energy and attention trying to look as much like irritated, hurrying assholes as possible. You know, when in Rome. The neighborhood, with its vacant lots and burned-out shells of buildings, couldn't have been much less welcoming. But all was forgotten when we opened the door to the apartment. Taking up half of the third floor, the apartment opened from a long, narrow brick hallway into a large, open loft, with a new kitchen and a new bathroom and new carpeting that almost actually fit the room, and an entire wall of south-facing windows. Despite the realty mantra, we took the apartment. At that point in my life, I was much more interested in living in a great apartment in a dodgy part of town than in a sweatbox in the best neighborhood. Screw location. The rent for the place was $850 a month, with Eric and I responsible for $250 each, and Bruce making up the difference. For his footing the bill, Bruce got the closest thing to a private room, a space at the end of the hall that he curtained off to his own private love nest, well, sex nest, anyway. Not sure how much love was involved in those days. Eric and I hired a carpenter to come in and build us loft beds on the edge of the big main room. Eric won the coin toss and got his in the corner against the wall. I lost and got to build mine a few feet away from his, jutting out from the wall like a pleasant peninsula. A few judiciously placed tapestries and our rooms were ready. Eric had the space to have a double bed-sized platform built and put his desk under it, so it really was like a little room. Me, I got shafted and had a single bed platform with just enough room underneath to throw my laundry. Any bigger and it would have cut too far into the main living area. Still, it was better than where I had just been living, and I was excited to have really established myself in the city. A good job, a swell apartment, I had it going on, and I could gleefully thumb my nose at those back home. Hi, Mom! That doubted my ability to survive in the city. About halfway through our year in that apartment, Eric had switched from being a pasta chef, or rather a pasta and cheese 1-2-3 chef, to working at a record store in Times Square. The only real perk to that job was getting to hear lots of stuff as it came out and getting to buy it with an employee discount, so he was often wandering home with some hot new slice of vinyl. Catch me if you
suicide statements are the measure of the man.
Many times I was less than impressed. Rain Parade? But this particular night, he brought home a strange disc called Into Battle with the Art of Noise. It was a Friday night, so I didn't have to go to work. I had since switched to the night shift and was walking home at 4 in the morning 4 times a week. And Bruce didn't even know what a job was, so we were hanging out, not doing much of anything. Well, I wasn't doing much of anything. But Bruce had dropped acid a couple of hours before and was screaming through a smiley trip while I tried to simultaneously stay out of his way and make sure his flight went well. Fresh out of high school, we were going through a period of fairly heavy drug experimentation. I had locked into smoking pot as my preferred form of mental adjustment. Well, who am I kidding? We were all smoking like fish at this point. And Bruce was doing a fair amount of blow, like any self-respecting, independently wealthy party kid should. And the three of us would take some sort of major trip about once a month, be it acid or shrooms or mescaline or MDA or whatever the hell we could get our hands onto. Bruce was going solo this night, so I contented myself with burning herb and trying to keep the vibe as positive as possible. Eric came in, quickly evaluated the situation, and told Bruce he had something new to listen to. Bruce graciously turned the stereo over to him, and Eric unwrapped his new disc, tossing the cover to me, knowing Bruce wouldn't even be able to read it at this point, and, after considering for a moment, put on side two. A seasoned veteran of internal adventures, Eric chose thoughtfully. Had he wanted to derail Bruce and send him screaming into a darker place, he could have put on side one, but he was nice and queued up the first track of side two. The track started with a round, staccato, breathy sound, tracing out a very simple 16-note phrase. Bruce immediately closed his eyes and started swaying in awe, an orgasmic look of pleasure on his face. Of course, he was tripping, so he probably would have done that if we'd switched the blender on. The phrase repeated a couple of times, adding small details to the mix, including dry bass thumps and the world's loudest finger snaps, before the strings kicked in and the track settled into a groove, punctuated by what sounded like a compressed orchestra bleeding out short chords. It was all very odd and seductive. There was a strange mixture of organic and artificial sounds, and I couldn't quite get my head around it. track stretched on and on, repeating the same 16-note phrase over and over again, glossed up in shiny clothes, but not really going anywhere. Bruce was performing an interpretive dance to the colors swirling through his head, and I peered at the record cover, trying to make sense of it. With its painting of knights going on the Crusades and pictures of spanners breaking windows and assertions that the group, quote, have an almost hygienic need for complications and can never accept that a full sentence can ever come from half a man, printed on its cover, the disc and whoever had made it seemed determined to be as impenetrably obscure as possible. A voice that was both artificial and natural sounding kept repeating moments in love over and over again, and the whole piece took on this weird otherworldly quality. It was soothing, mesmerizing even, but faintly creepy too. There was just enough variation in what was going on to keep it interesting, but not enough to make it feel like it was made by humans. I glanced over at Eric, who smiled enigmatically from behind the barn. Just as it seemed the track would go on forever, and just as Bruce started to get bored and was about to suggest a change of stimulus, the track started shifting. Everything died away except for the thumping bass, stuck on one note, over and over again. Then this strange, slightly warbly voice muttered, "Now," and another voice started moaning. The piece had taken a definite turn to the dark side, and Bruce stopped dancing and glanced nervously at the stereo and at the two of us. And then, just as suddenly as it had started, the weird middle section evaporated, and we went back to the plodding, hypnotic, breathy cycle that started the piece, with a disembodied voice once again intoning "Moments in Love." But now, having gone through that disorienting middle section, the syrupy strings and repeated vocal fragments sounded even more ominous than they had before. Yeah. Although it came years before David Lynch's masterpiece was released, it had the same effect as the end of Blue Velvet, in which the happy hyper-normalcy of the opening sequence is recalled after the horror of Frank Booth has played itself out. Jeffrey and Sandy are back together. The bad has been banished, the good is back, and the fake birds twitch in the two green trees. Moments in Love is a stupendous track, capturing some of the ineffable hope and fear that love can inject into your life, and it has become a powerful touchstone for me throughout my life, despite the fact that Madonna chose it to walk down the aisle to when she married Sean Penn. Eric wisely refrained from playing the rest of the record while Bruce was in such a highly suggestible state, but the next day, intrigued, I pulled it out and listened to the whole thing. Moments in Love is an anomaly on that disc. Most of the other tracks are considerably shorter, Moments in Love clocks in around 10 minutes, and considerably noisier. The rest of the record was filled with strangely funky collages of industrial sounds mixed together with boogie-woogie bass lines, stolen vocal samples, heavily manipulated found sonic shards, and the biggest, most exhilarating drum sound I'd ever heard. I was immediately captivated. Melodies were constructed using the manipulated sound of an engine starting, or a bite of the Andrews Sisters singing In the Army Now from Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. It's there that permeates the disturbing middle section of Moments in Love. There's a faux horror soundtrack snippet consisting largely of footsteps and a giant twisted organ. There's a moody spy movie theme that utilizes a breathy sample and a few chords stolen from Stravinsky's Petrushka. Don't Strange disembodied voices get caught in the dense mix and repeat their fragmentary message over and over again, getting twisted and mangled in the process. There is an exhilarating and bewildering sense of experimentation, and it truly sounded like nothing I had ever heard. All in all, it is a pretty uneven disc, with tracks bumping awkwardly into each other and suddenly getting cut off in the middle of a... But it's a fascinating work, full of intriguing ideas, and I was immediately smitten. Producer Trevor Horn brought classically trained keyboard player Ann Dudley and computer whiz J.J. Jekselik together as session musicians during a production of ABC's glossy pop confection, The Lexicon of Love. They worked together on a few more projects over the next couple of years, including Malcolm McLaren's seminal Duck Rock, which also features Thomas Bilby. And Yes's career-revitalizing 90125 album. The name is not a zip code, a la Beverly Hills 90210, but the catalog number of the album. During the sometimes tense 90125 sessions, Horn and Dudley and Jekselik started putting their various areas of expertise together. Horn with his astonishing production skills, Dudley with their classical training, and Jekselik with his inventive synthesizer programming, for a few experimental tracks. These experiments led directly to the formation of Art of Noise, the first group to be released on Horn's new Zhang Tum Tum label, distributed by Island in exchange for their appreciation for him supplying that label with their only British number one hit, Buggles' Video Killed the Radio Star. In many ways, Art of Noise, name taken from an Italian futurist manifesto, fulfilled the promise of those pioneers of musique concrète, who 40 years earlier, the movement was officially started by Pierre Schaeffer in 1948, wanted to take music making out of the hands of a rarefied few using only officially sanctioned instruments playing in authorized venues and make the entire world a musical instrument. Music isn't just violins sawing away in unison, they said. It's also in birdsong and in the sound of a dump truck and the way the wind whistles through the wires. Art of Noise took that concept and applied it to the most up-to-date technology available, the Fairlight CMI. Computer musical instrument. Breathtakingly powerful and prohibitively expensive, the Fairlight was the first real sampler available to musicians, the first instrument that could record sounds of the real world and use the digital profiles of those sounds in creating new sounds. Other synthesizers built their complex timbres up by combining and modifying a few basic raw waveforms, the sine wave, the triangle, the sawtooth, the square, and varying amounts of white or pink noise, random and semi-random swatches of the sonic spectrum, otherwise heard as static. But now, the sound of the crumb horn could be mixed with a sneeze and manipulated into a whole new world of sonic possibility. Shortly after Into Battle, Art of Noise released a 12-inch single of two variations of one of the tracks on that first disc. Called Beatbox, a nickname for the drum machines that were starting to take over and make drummers very nervous, the original track featured a thundering hip-hop beat underneath some stylized, musicalized sound effect samples. The remix single, clearly aimed for the dance floor because of its format, takes those embryonic ideas and riffs on them, pumping up the boogie-woogie bass line, refining the samples, and throwing whatever they could think of into the mix. Although extremely experimental by pop music standards, or by any music standards really, Art of Noise also had a good sense of humor, and the disc is peppered with lots of humorous moments and comical vocal bites.
To be in England in the summertime with my love, close to the edge.
It is a stunning, groundbreaking single, and took the underground dance world by storm. Not only was the content of the track excitingly novel, with tuned engine solos nestled in next to arty piano riffs and breaking glass effects rubbed up against eviscerated vocal bites, but the drum sound was bigger and thicker and meatier than anything else coming out of the embryonic electronica scene. Some of that was a matter of economics.
Ready, one, two, three, four.
When the techno and house revolutions started in Detroit and Chicago, respectively, they were underground dance sensations created by fringe musicians and producers. These fledgling knob twiddlers had very little money to spend equipping their studios, So the machines they could afford were bottom-of-the-line toss-offs, most famously the Roland 808 and 909 drum machines, and the perversely cheesy 303 bassline sequencer. The sounds were thin and tinny and tiny and artificial, but they became the sound of the new scene, to the point that their feather-light sounds continued to be exploited by dance producers long after the technology changed to allow bigger, more realistic sounds. A few dance-oriented producers, notably British dub freak Adrian Sherwood, Yellow's mastermind Boris Blank, and Trevor Horn, shunned the fashionably tinniness of the times and tried to add a little muscle to the mix. On these two beatbox variations, creatively titled Diversion 1 and Diversion 2, Horn takes the fashionable compressed gated drum sound pioneered on Peter Gabriel's third solo album, called, like the first two, Peter Gabriel, and cranks it up through the roof, making it sound like an anvil slamming into your head. As a technical aside, that popular drum sound was achieved by running a drum hit through a noise gate that has been set unnaturally high. A noise gate only lets sounds of a certain volume through, and is usually used on acoustic instruments and especially vocals to minimize background sounds, fret noise, and any other distracting and unwanted ambience. By applying it to drums and setting the gate impossibly high, only the very loudest part of the hit gets through, and as soon as the volume starts to decay, the gate cuts the signal off completely, giving the drums a highly stylized, super chunky sound. And because there's virtually no delay, you can drop these beat bombs in the track without muddying up the mix too much. Shortly thereafter, Art of Noise released their first proper album, Who's Afraid of the Art of Noise? Into Battle is considered an EP, or albumette, as they call it, although it runs longer than many albums. Featuring Moments in Love and a slightly trimmed version of Diversion 2 called Close to the Edit, Who's Afraid became the defining album for the Art of Noise. We'll be right back. a video for Close to the Edit, directed by one of my favorite unknown experimental film and video directors, Zbigniew Rybczynski, featured a couple of guys in suits and a tarted-up punkette cheerfully chainsawing a grand piano into bits in some unidentified industrial wasteland, making visual and visceral their affront to the musical establishment. Carrying on from their early experiments, the album liberally mixes both art and noise to stunning effect, and catalyzed the nascent electronica scene. Although they were never terribly popular, Art of Noise's early sonic explorations into musique concrete with a killer beat remains one of the most important touchstones of that era and informs much of the dance music that followed it. At that time, early 1983, hip-hop was still in its infancy, and rap had just broken out of the brag party straitjacket. Grandmaster Flash's epic and revolutionary track, The Message, had just been recently released, and it set a new standard for lyrical content in a rap song, using it to make social commentaries and critiques.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
The widespread success of that track heralded a new age in rap and signaled its desire and ability to be taken seriously. But the music was still a ways behind. Most rap tracks were looped funk riffs that provided a steady beat but didn't get in the way of the words. Dance music was either trying to shake off the disco hangover with straight-ahead, four-on-the-floor beats underneath the screaming divas, Shannon's Let the Music Play, and the Weather Girls' It's Raining Men were unavoidable club fixtures of the day.
We started dancing and love put us into our groove. As soon as we started to move.
Or was clogged with lots of catchy but embarrassing novelty songs. Men Without Hats' Safety Dance, or Tonko's perverse version of Putting on the Ritz.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Putting on the Ritz.
Art of Noise's willingness to throw out lyrics entirely in favor of short, sampled phrases and focus on the texture of the track and the strength of the beats was almost unheard of at the time. Now it is so common as to be cliché, but at the time, it was quite a revolutionary approach. Of course, the real story in popular music at that moment was the unprecedented popularity of Michael Jackson's Thriller album, which kept spitting out hit singles and had so overtaken the world in general, and New York City in particular, that I couldn't walk out of my apartment without hearing the seductive, shuffling backbeat of Billie Jean echoing from 1,000 windows and stoops. After Close to the Edit became a moderate hit, Art of Noise released a blinding blur of one-off remixes of the track. Every week, it seemed, a new mix would come out, confounding early fans, I largely gave up after chasing a few of these phantom tracks and hemorrhaging cash in the process. It was an irritating in-house joke for Zhang Tum Tub Records, who were also doing the same thing with their one flash in the pan cash cow, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and their archetypal track, Relax. After the myriad beatbox remixes, Art of Noise splintered. Ann and JJ and engineer Gary Langan carried on with the name to a new label. Actually, they changed their name slightly from Art of Noise to The Art of Noise, for what it's worth, and left Trevor and original member Paul Morley behind. Morley was responsible for the marketing and look and logos of the group, reminiscent of those bloated 70s prog rockers that included their lighting designer as a full-time band member. According to which camp you set your tent in, either Dudley and Jekselik wanted to get out from under Horn's considerable thumb, or they betrayed Horn and Morley's ideals of Art of Noise being a deeply conceptual postmodern critique of a pop group to sell out and become a defanged actual pop group. According to the liner notes from Daft, a collection of Zhang Tum Tum tracks the group recorded in 1983, members Jekselik, Dudley, and Langan, disconcerted by Horn and Morley's subversive attempts to bruise the complacency of the rock industry and prepare a long-term, large-scale project of celebration, interpretation, and malice, have retained the name Art of Noise as the commercial success associated with it suits their brazen, career-besotted attitude. Perhaps Dudley and Jekselik did sell out, but how long would you want to be trapped in a studio with somebody that talked like that? Horn and Morley threatened to form a competing group called Act and Art, but that never materialized, although that may have been part of the inspiration for a rare Art of Noise B-side called Act and Art that was released on the back of the Dragnet single. After living together in that loft for almost a year, things started falling apart. Eric was getting tired of having breakfast with a revolving cast of Calvin Klein underwear models that Bruce would bring home. I was getting tired of the work, drugs, work rut that my life had fallen into, and Bruce was getting tired of us not being rich and gay. So we agreed to split up and go our separate ways. Bruce stayed in the loft, and I sold him my speakers to get out of debt to him. Eric moved uptown and started attending Juilliard to get his dance studies back on track. And I applied to and was accepted at Hampshire College, where I joined the F84 class. You are classified by your starting date at Hampshire instead of your graduation date, so as not to oppress you with society's straitjacket of expectations, man. Part of the reason I had gone back to school was that my disastrous year at the University of Chicago had faded from memory enough to let me think that the problem may not be all colleges, but that one in particular. I was also keen to try something a little more challenging than going to work every day and smoking pot all the time, and thought completely changing my environment might be a good way to do that. Although, if I was really serious about avoiding drugs, I should probably have picked a different school than Hampshire College. Anyway, Early in my second year, I stumbled across a delightful new Art of Noise single called Legs, which wryly featured a sample from a Legs pantyhose commercial. I hoped this track was clearing the way for a new album, so I bided my time while wearing out Legs' considerable grooves and my neighbor's patience. Then, one afternoon, while slogging my way through a paper, there was a knock on my dorm room door. I opened it to see my friend Jeff, grinning maniacally and clutching the new Art of Noise album, Invisible Silence. He ran down the hall to his room, having a far superior stereo, and I eagerly followed him. Jeff and I had hit it off early in the year. Compact, don't call him short, he's taller than NBA slam dunker Spud Webb, he likes to point out, and wiry, with bushy brown hair and a fulled beard, Jeff looked like one of the crunchy granola Earth First types that were legion at a place like Hampshire, although, as I was delighted to discover, he was a lot more cynical than those irritatingly ungrounded Grateful Dead followers that ran rampant and stunk up the place with their idealism and patchouli. Quiet and shy, Jeff shared with me a passion for certain types of music, beady, synthetic, and free from extraneous singing, and he had a similarly jaded outlook on life, although his came from a different place. In my household, creative expression was held to be the highest pursuit one could devote themselves to. In the years since that ideal had been instilled in me, I had come to realize the futility and frustration of such endeavors. Those who were the most successful were almost always those that were the least creative, and those that were the most vitally creative often starved to death in obscurity, only to have their reputations redeemed long after they'd shuffled off this mortal coil, if ever. As much as some of the popular arts are rewarded in this culture, to the tune of $20 million per picture, most of what passes for culture is almost unbearably depressing schlock. I was coming to realize that I'd been sold a bill of goods. Jeff, on the other hand, was taught to honor science and rationality as the highest human ideals.
The search for truth.
He had also recently become disillusioned with those ideals, with his understanding of the real nature of science, politics as usual, and with the overbearing hubris and selfishness of much of what passes for enlightened rationality.
The search for truth.
I had come to Hampshire from the depths of the most urban of cities, and he arrived fresh out of the wilds of Alaska. So remote that once he stopped by while I had Billie Jean playing on the stereo and, after nodding his head agreeably for a couple of minutes, said, "Hey, this is pretty good. What is it?" This was, I should point out, over 2 years after Thriller had been released. So although much of our surface experiences were radically different, the clocks that ticked inside were largely in sync, and we quickly became good friends.
Tá bom.
Jeff broke the seal and carefully slipped the record out of its jacket and put it on his turntable. Ah, the smell of fresh vinyl. And cranked it up while we settled back in to enjoy the new tunes and pore over the record jacket.
New sun,
dust,
new sun, 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 new sun,
no more,
new sun,
no new,
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 new sun.
Invisible Silence starts with a poetic trifle called Opus 4, which uses looped and layered vocal bits to build an elaborate pun.
New sun,
no more,
new sun,
no more,
new sun,
no more,
new sun. No proper time of day.
No shade, no shade, no shade, no shine,
no bird.
No shade, no shade, no shade, no shine,
no bird.
No shade,
bees.
No shade, no shade,
bees.
Although the group had sold out by splintering away from Horn's Zang Tum Tub label, Invisible Silence was hardly the mass market pandering their former label mates sniffily accused them of making. And although they had also purged willful obfuscationist Paul Morley, the new release was no less impenetrable than Who's Afraid, with their dedication to both Bill and Edmund Halley, their sly in-jokes, and their fixation with early photographs by Edward Muybridge, whose photographic series of people and animals in action revolutionized the way movement was seen and portrayed, paving the way for motion pictures. Not as anachronistic as it may seem, as the Art of Noise was doing to the sounds of the natural world, breaking them into unnaturally small pieces, what Muybridge did with images.
November.
As proof that Invisible Silence was still about as far from a standard pop record as you could get, it took us until the fourth track before we realized that Jeff had his turntable set to 45 RPMs instead of 33. Remember records? And we only caught it then because track 4 is Legs. If we both hadn't have been as familiar with that track as we were, we could have very easily listened to the entire album at the wrong speed and never noticed. I can't help but think the Art of Noise would approve. Unfortunately, for all of their far-out experimentation, there was a bit of a novelty track on Invisible Silence that drastically altered both the band's trajectory and their public image. Dusting off King of Twang, Dwayne Eddy, for a high-octane cover of Henry Mancini's classic Peter Gunn theme, The Art of Noise struck gold, and, consciously or not, that marked out the group's final niche in the wider public's perception. They quickly remixed one of the disc's finer tracks, The Sublime Paranoia, to include guest vocalizing by the world's first virtual reality star, Max Headroom. The remix trades the original's subtle pulse and refined Shakespeare with a four-on-the-floor raver smothered with Max's tiresome ranting.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll take over now.
And let's have a little taste of it. A little taste of that old computer-generated swagger. Yes.
And the remix was such a hit, well, relatively speaking, that they replaced the original version with a headroom mix on subsequent pressings. Although not as bracingly noisy or astonishing as the group's first album, Invisible Silence is a wonderful disc, my overall favorite of theirs. Some criticize it as being too glossy and polished, but I'll take its alluring sheen over Who's Afraid's sometimes off-putting angularity. Years into my career at Hampshire, I went back to Interlaken to begin work on my final project, my thesis, if you will, or my Div 3, if you won't. It was the 25th anniversary of the Interlaken Arts Academy, and through a lucky combination of cojones and timing, I managed to talk the powers that be into funding a documentary of the Academy, and to put me up for the entire academic year it took to shoot it. I had managed to convince them partly because of my pedigree. Having lived on campus for 10 years, I still knew most of the faculty and staff, and having been a camper, a day student, a boarding student, the son of a faculty member, and a staff member, I knew Interlaken in a way few others could, which got me the job, but then threw me into an odd social group when I arrived on campus with my video camera and cases of tape. I was too old to mingle seamlessly with the students, and I wasn't really on the faculty or a staff member. Although it would have been perfectly appropriate for me to hang out with the faculty, most of them were considerably older than I was, and many of them had been my teachers and were good friends of my folks, who had just left a couple of years before, so I didn't feel at ease with them in the same way as I would have with my peers, if I had any. Fortunately, there was Ramon, the piano accompanist for the dance department and a true mad musical genius. He lived in the duplex next door, and the two of us staked out our own irreverent territory on campus, each saving the other from the brutal cabin fever that could easily happen out there in the North Woods, buried under feet of snow for months at a time. I also, reluctantly but excitingly, got involved briefly with a student. Achingly beautiful, she took a fancy to me, probably enticed more by my age, 22 to her 16, than to anything else about me. I'm sure she was hoping for an exciting and illicit tryst with an experienced older man, but she was infinitely more experienced than I was, which was, and continues to be, a badge of shame for me. I had had a few disastrous attempts at intimacy and was rapidly becoming the world's oldest virgin, and my brief dalliance with this dancer didn't help matters one bit. I wrote off my physical failures to my fears about inappropriate contact, not to mention jail time, and her father, a reputed mobster, but the seeds of doubt that had been planted years before sprouted into a thick, tangled vine that year, one that wrapped its thorns around my battered heart. In order to come to grips with what I feared facing, I worked on an abstract music video, illustrating my conflicting desire for and fear of intimacy. When the mood struck me, I pulled out the video camera and shot footage of flowers burning, or me crying, or relics from my career as a dancer, whatever visuals I could find that resonated with my emotional state. It was my sustaining secret that year, and I quietly filled up 6 tapes worth of footage to be molded the next year when I got back to Hampshire and could begin editing. After spending months poring over my official footage the next year and starting to carve it together into one large, semi-coherent piece, I pulled my secret tapes out of storage, grabbed Who's Afraid of the Art of Noise, and went into the editing bay. Six hours went by in a blur, part of the reason I became an editor, and I emerged with Moment, the music video of my fearful heart set to the improbably appropriate Moments in Love. I nervously showed it to my advisor right before Christmas break, and he was blown away, saying it qualified by itself as my Division 3, and, as far as he was concerned, I could graduate right then and there. But, since I'd already promised Interlock in the finished tape and still had 5 months to work on it with no pesky classes to get in the way, I soldiered on. I also showed the video to a new friend of mine, Christine. Smart, funny, and impassioned, with short brown hair cut in that unfortunate shelf at the back of the neck thing that was popular at the time, and beautiful hazel eyes that changed color with the weather, mood eyes, she was many things that I was not. She was strongly idealistic and optimistic about her ability to make the world a better place. She was fiercely liberal, she never backed down from an argument, much to the chagrin of her family, and would articulately and accurately dismember any opposing viewpoints. Despite, or perhaps because of, our differences, we found comfort in each other's company. Although we had been in many of the same classes and had done a lot of the same things at the same times, we didn't get to be friends until our final year at Hampshire. She was also an F-84. Once we found each other, however, we started spending all of our time together, and although the threat of romance colored our relationship, I staunchly denied it, afraid to disappoint and be disappointed once again. On the night before Christmas break, I held my breath and unspooled Moment for her, and she hated it. She hated the cliched images, the predictable cutting, the lack of media subversion. Hampshire was big on deconstruction at the time. Although Hampshire was the right school for me in many ways, I was at odds with much of the video department because I wanted to make pretty pictures, and the official Hampshire line at that time was to storm the gallery, studio, theater, rip the offending pretty pictures, films, books from the elitist walls, pages, screen, and trample them underfoot, exposing the rampant sexism, racism, whateverism that the evil purveyors of media used to sway the uncritical masses and poison their minds with glossy propaganda. Or something like that. Christine later confessed that the blatant longing and sexuality of Moment freaked her out, making her think things about me she was trying not to think about, but I don't know. I think she hated it because she thought it sucked. Whatever her true feelings about Moment, they didn't stop her from marrying me 4 years later. After Invisible Silence, The Art of Noise continued with the forced pun album titles In No Sense, Nonsense, and Below the Waist, W-A-S-T-E.
Think I better dance now!
And with their hyperkinetic covers of old spy tunes, Dragnet and James Bond, and surprising guest stars, the Fat Boys' Human Beatbox sputtering over Roller One, or Tom Jones singing Prince's Kiss.
You don't have to be beautiful to turn me on. I just need your body, baby, from dusk till dawn.
Although there is much of merit on these later albums, their admittedly fun but ultimately ill-advised gimmicky tracks pigeonholed them as a novelty act, at least to the wider public. Budding electronica fans, however, digested everything they had to offer, and by the mid-90s, after they had disbanded, they were widely recognized as one of the most important and influential electronica acts ever, even getting the reverential remix disc treatment three separate times, an ambient version, by far the best of the bunch, and a disc of straight-up techno remixes and a disc of drum and bass remixes. Cheers. The arc of Art of Noise can be seen as going away from noise and towards art, with later albums utilizing boys' choirs and full orchestras. By the last track on their final album, the transformation was complete. The appropriately titled Finale is a straight-up string orchestra piece with no visible electronics whatsoever, and having finished the evolution, or devolution, depending on who you talk to, the Art of Noise disbanded. Ann Dudley had the most visibly successful career after they broke up, going on to score films both significant, The Crying Game, and not, Disorderlies, eventually winning an Academy Award for her score to the sleeper hit The Full Monty. She also collaborated with Killing Joke's Jazz Coleman for a surprising disc of revamped Arabic instrumentals called Songs from the Victorious City, and released an album of sleepy chamber music called Ancient and Modern. Throughout their career, the Art of Noise did an admirable job of living up to its name. Carefully balancing art and noise, the intellect and the soul, the head, the heart, and the feet, Art of Noise was a true pioneer, absorbing the cultural detritus of the 20th century and spitting it back out in inventive and compelling commentaries and critiques, set to a maddeningly catchy beat. Truly one of a kind, they freely mixed high and lowbrow culture to create an exciting hybrid. They may not have been very popular in their day, but their footsteps continue to reverberate through the long halls of electronica. Who is afraid of the Art of Noise? Not me. Bring it on.